Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising.
Hey, listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue unlocks the potential of your entire donor pyramid. But how? Why, by giving fundraising teams the tools they need to personalize outreach at scale. Wow. And to inspire fundraising teams along the way, we offer Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub. Evertrue Studios is like Netflix, but for advancement. And we publish new podcast and video content every week. It's all free and all created with fundraisers in mind. Subscribe for weekly content from the Development Debrief podcast and other advancement thought leaders at evertrue.com/studios.
Liz comes from a family of storytellers. This week, we learn about how she's found her voice as a communication specialist, a trustee, and so much more. She tells us how her education impacted her in different ways and led her to write about her great uncle and philanthropist, A.G. Gaston. Liz cites what she calls movement moments and mentors along the way. Elizabeth G. Hines is an author, editor, and strategic communication specialist. She was the founding education editor at alternet.org, a syndication service and online community of the alternative press, and her written work has appeared in numerous online publications. Together with her mother, Carol Jenkins, Hines is the co-author of the best-selling biography, Black Titan, A.G. Gaston and the Making of a Black American Millionaire, winner of the 2004 Nonfiction Book Honor from the American Library Association. In 2022, Hines served as the editor of the anthology Aftermath, Life in Post-Roe America, a collection of more than 35 feminist voices on the loss of Roe v. Wade and the impact the erosion of reproductive freedom will have on American society as a whole. Previously, Ms. Hines served as the communications director for the White House Project, a 501c3 organization that worked to increase female representation in American institutions, businesses, and government. She was also a senior member of the communications team at the Miss Foundation for Women, and now heads her own communications and consulting business, which works with foundations and advocacy organizations to advance their communications capabilities and improve their messaging effectiveness. Her clients have included the Miss Foundation for Women, the New York Women's Foundation, International Council for Research on Women, the Steinem Initiative at Smith College, the Independent Media Institute, and the New World Foundation. Throughout her career, Ms. Hines has dedicated herself to helping nonprofits grow, in part by serving on boards of a wide variety of organizations, including the Third Wave Fund, the Women's Media Center Advisory Board, the Legal Information for Families Today, People Production House, and the Independent Media Institute, as well as the Hotchkiss School. In 2018, Hines was named a fellow of the New World Foundation, where she oversaw the organization's research on the state of local media, investigating opportunities to support local journalism and journalists in the face of widespread media corporatization. Ms. Hines holds a BA from Yale University and conducted her graduate studies at Harvard University. She lives in New York with her partner and their three children. Now let's get started. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the Debrief.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's particularly exciting that you're a Yale alum, since I'm now at Yale, and maybe we'll hear a little bit about your time there. But I think we should start with talking about your education. You've had a fabulous education at Hotchkiss and then at Yale for undergrad and Harvard for your PhD. Are there any inflection points or important parts of those experiences that you think have led you to where you are now in your career?
Oh, sure. I say all the time that I use the things that I was taught first at Hotchkiss and then at Yale, and then that were sort of pounded into me in a different way at Harvard every single day, right? Wow. So Hotchkiss is and was a place where writing, learning how to be a great writer was paramount and is paramount. I don't think you leave a Hotchkiss education without really understanding how to write an A-plus, deeply persuasive, well-thought-out, and well-executed essay. And so, you know, when I think about my career now, which involves storytelling and writing, I know for a fact that I wouldn't be where I am now without the training I received at Hotchkiss and that I learned to hone at Yale and then again at Harvard. So those were, you know, those educational opportunities have meant everything to me in my life. And it's why it's a large part of the reason why I am as involved as I am at Hotchkiss, because I do feel a huge debt of gratitude to that institution in particular, and to my other institutions for giving me the skills to be able to be a successful professional in the way that I am today.
And when it comes to writing, was that something that you had a level of comfort with from, you know, from the beginning, or was it something that you struggled with when you were younger?
Well, no, I come from a family of storytellers. My mother was a television journalist. And so I grew up in a household where there was a TV in every room. And very often my mother was on it. And she stories, right? As far as my little brain knew, she was telling stories. And so when I was quite young, I started telling stories in the mirror, sort of doing what I saw my mother doing. And that's how my storytelling began. And then at a certain stage, I realized actually that I was quite good at translating those stories from the spoken word to the written word. And yeah, and so I just developed a passion for it. And it was, writing is never easy. I don't think there's anybody who would say, you know, oh, this is the easy way to go. It's not. But, you know, it is something, you know, I think of like my eldest child, who's, you know, my daughter Avery, is a visual artist, and I can't draw to save my life. But it's interesting to watch other people in other pursuits chase after something that just does sort of like flow from them. Right. And I think for me, writing was, and storytelling has just been something that came a little bit naturally with a lot of hard work and effort put behind it.
Yeah. So you mentioned that writing was sort of a cornerstone of the Hotchkiss experience. How were the other degrees different? How were they similar? What were other takeaways from that those experiences?
That's interesting. I think when I got to Yale, I'm trying to remember what I thought I wanted to major in. And maybe it was comp lit. I think, you know, because I took French and I thought for a long time that I wanted to be a comparative literature major. And then sort of somewhere along my Yale journey, I decided actually, no, I wanted to focus on English literature. You know, I think the thing about my Yale experience was, as I assume most people would say, I mean, it just forced me into a higher level of thinking about the subjects that I was writing about. You know, I had fabulous teachers, world class, you know, sitting at the feet of these people whose names everybody's heard, and being asked to not take the easy road in terms of thinking about any given text or writing about any given text, but really to sort of dig way deeper than you had ever thought about digging before, and being able to create a narrative that was consistent and coherent across a 15, 20 page paper. I'm not writing a lot of 15, 20 page essays these days, but those skills are useful to me all the time in my work with my clients. And just in, you know, I think in thinking about and analyzing everyday issues in the world. So Yale certainly upped the ante. And then the Harvard PhD experience is like a slightly different thing, because then that's just, I mean, you're a graduate student, you're totally focused on, you know, whatever your particular pursuit is. And actually, my experience in graduate school led me to step away from pursuing my PhD, because my advisor actually said to me at one point, I was sitting in her office, and she said, I said, you know, I'm not sure if this is exactly what I want to do for the rest of my life, if, you know, I want to teach. And she said, the only regret I have in my life is that I didn't take a break during my PhD work or before my PhD work to see the world. She said, this place will always be here. You can always come back, take a leave of absence if you want, go out and see the world. And if this place draws you back, you will be drawn back to it and you'll finish the degree. And great. But you know, she said, you may go out there and decide and see that there are other things that you're just as passionate about, if not more so. And I took her advice.
Oh,
and
my God.
I took a leave and I moved to New York, which is where I'm from, back to New York. And I got a job in the publishing industry. And that decision led to the publication of my first book. So, you know, when I think about like inflection points in my life and people who have had extraordinary impact on my life, Barbara Johnson, who has since passed away, you know, had a real impact on the trajectory of my life because she gave me permission to take a chance. You know, she's like, wow, you can do this. There's no doubt you can do this. You can finish your PhD, you'll get a job, you'll do the thing, but why not find out if this is really what matters most to you? And so I'm grateful all the time that she gave me that permission that I needed at that stage of the game to take a risk.
Yeah. Well, we know you went on to work with some organizations that were focused on women's rights and reproductive justice, but let's talk about your first book, Your Great Uncle. I know you had told me that writing that book with your mom was one of the things that really got you excited about philanthropy. So tell us more.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. My great uncle was a man named A.G. Gaston, and he lived in Birmingham, Alabama, for 103 years. So the book is actually almost a history of the United States over the course of the 20th century, because that was the span of his lifetime. He died when he was 103 years old. And he, you know, started out with very little and just slowly but very intentionally built basically an empire in Birmingham that started with funeral insurance. And then he bought funeral homes and then he bought cemeteries. And eventually he moved to banking and communications and really just, you know, by the end of his life, I think his fortune was estimated to be worth about $140 million. And this was all in, you know, and this is like early mid 20th century kind of thing. And the interesting thing is, you know, he built this fortune and this company serving the needs of the Black residents of the state of Alabama when white-owned companies would not provide them those services. So he started helping people bury their loved ones because there were no services available to Black people in the state of Alabama to do that. So he saw the need and he filled it. That was one of his signature lines about how to be successful in business, find a need and fill it. And that's what he did. And he was hugely successful. But what really called to me about his story was what he decided to do with his wealth, which was largely give it away. You know, he sold his company back to his employees for a fraction of its worth, and it's called an employee stock option program. And he invested all around him in education. So, you know, he and his wife built a vocational college. And I also tell the story of, you know, my mom has... A.G. was married to one of my grandmother's sisters, and there were 13 children in that family. So my mom has about 45 first cousins.
Oh my God.
And what is true is that A.G. and Minnie, his wife, made sure that every single one of those kids in that generation, if they needed help, could get to college, right? So they invested in the community around them, and they also invested in their family. And I also will say that when I went to graduate school and I was buying my books in graduate school, I used a savings bond that they had bought me when I was born to buy my books.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that something? You know, so when you think about like what it means to invest in generations, you know, they're just such an incredible story of, you know, looking to the future and saying, you know, we're not taking this with us. How are we actually going to deploy this to improve people's lives?
Yeah, I was going to ask you how it affected or impacted your family in addition to the community. Were there other ways? Do you know if it inspired other giving or?
Yeah, you know, I think Uncle Arthur, he was kind of a tough guy, but, you know, and his view, as we understand it and as we knew it, was largely to say, like, if you were a member of his family, you certainly would not want to come to him to ask for money. He would make it really hard for you. In part because, you know, he had worked really hard to build what he had built, but mm-hmm. also I think because he felt, you know, Birmingham is not, and certainly then was not such a big place. And most of the community sort of knew who was related to him. And so I think he felt very much as if the people in his family accrued a certain benefit just from being related to him. Mm. You know, so his view was like, look, if you want something and you want to achieve something, you're going to have to work really hard for it, right? We're not just sort of like handing out cash because we have it, right? And there are lots of people in this community who probably need it more than you do. What I think he inspired was a work ethic in the family. Our family, you know, they were farmers, and my great grandfather, you know, they had 9 girls, 6 boys. All of the girls went to college. All of the boys stayed on the farm to work. And so my great grandfather, as my mother always says, was like the first feminist in our family, because he understood that investing in his daughter's education was going to be the family's ticket to success long term. And so, you know, I think our family really does have a sense of, you know, there is a responsibility to work hard, to try your best, and to be involved in the community around you, wherever you are, and in whatever way you see fit, but, you know, that you don't just sort of, you know, make it and then sit back on your laurels and say, look at me, you know, you gotta be involved.
What was the writing process like with, you know, doing that with your mom? I mean, that just must have been so incredible.
It was great. You know, my mother is an extraordinary storyteller, and she loves research. So she would go off into, you know, the Library of Congress and wherever, and just disappear and like collect all of the information. And then she would come back and she would sort of feed it to me, and we would sit down, and then I would, you know, take the research and the information and write. And then, you know, I would send her a draft and she would edit, and, you know, we would go back and forth and that sort of thing. You could imagine that it, as mothers and daughters, can sometimes those things can be tricky, but actually it was a really, there were moments where we disagreed about things, but that happens in life anyway. But I think we were both so invested in really wanting to get this story told and making sure that people understood what, you know, who he was and what his legacy was. And in particular, too, that there were more stories of Black people, Black Americans in the world who were not necessarily musicians and athletes, both of whom I have a great deal of respect for, but to show that, you know, Black people have been succeeding in this country on a lot of different levels, on a lot of different platforms for a long time. And we just don't know their stories as much as we know some of the other stories. So it was important to us to get this out there.
Knowing that he had that success as a Black man just makes it even more incredible and impressive and exciting that he was using that for the Black community. We'll probably never fully know the impact.
I know. And one of the things, you know, that he actually did do, as we all know, the civil rights movement marched right through Birmingham, Alabama. I had never stopped to ask the question, you know, you learn in history class about all the marchers who were arrested and, you know, the protesters who were put in jail. And I really had never stopped to ask, well, how did they get out of jail? Like, who bailed them out? And one of the answers is my uncle. He was involved. I mean, that's one of the way he used his wealth, was to help people. Now, and also remember, he built his fortune on providing services to a community that had been shut out of the larger economic structure. The civil rights movement was almost certainly going to undercut his hold on that community. And he knew it, right? Like from a business perspective, he was going to lose market share.
Thank
God, he was a decent human being who understood that, you know, there are things above, you know, the bottom line, and in fact, you know, helped in the way that he knew how to help support the civil rights movement as it was, you know, as it was coming through Alabama. And it was his hotel that, you know, Martin Luther King stayed in. And when he was writing Letter from a Birmingham Jail, it was my great uncle who got a call from Bobby Kennedy saying to him, "Mr. Gaston, you have to get King out of prison." And I think my uncle was like, well, you know, I'm not sure that he, because King did not want to come out because he knew that it was a lever, right? It was him being in prison was doing some of the work that needed to be done in order to push people in the direction of making change. But what Kennedy said to my great uncle was, if he stays in prison, more people are going to die. He has to come out. It's too dangerous of a situation. And my great uncle happened to agree with him and helped get King released from prison, which Martin Luther King was not happy about, right? That was not what he was, I think, planning. But it's just interesting to think about, you know, this person who I grew up knowing, you know, he would never talk about that sort of thing. But in doing the research for the book, you learn all sorts of things about the role he played in a lot of different movement moments.
So after having done this, what's your best guess on his donor motivation for all of this? You know, it seems like it was so innate, you know, based on everything that you've said, but I just wonder if there was anything you could point to.
Look, I mean, he grew up with grandparents who had been enslaved. And he grew up with a mother who was a cook in the kitchen of a white family who owned a department store in Alabama. And he grew up in a situation in which I think every day his humanity as a person was put into question because of the color of his skin. And I think when you grow up under those circumstances, I suspect that for many, many people, you know, once you get to a certain level of success, you look back and think to yourself, wow, I've come a long way, but I look around and I still see so much pain and I still see so much poverty and I look down the street and I see the guy and that could have been me. And how can I help make things better for that person? And so I think he was just motivated by, you know, the experiences of his life. That just, he knew he was a smart person. He knew that he, you know, had every bit of the, you know, gumption and skill to make it in the world that the guy standing next to him did, just that nobody saw that because he happened to have brown skin. And, you know, I think a lot, many, many, you know, people from marginalized communities, you know, historically underrepresented communities, I think many of us grow up and look around and go, yeah, you know, we have a responsibility, you know, because our communities do still struggle. And I think most of us want to figure out what the highest and best use of, you know, our donor dollars can be in order to make, you know, the world a little bit better for the people coming up behind us.
Well, the beautiful thing is you are absolutely continuing on his legacy. And one of those ways that you're doing that is by being a trustee at the Hotchkiss School. So how did you find your way there? And do you think there's a part of you that got there because of your great uncle?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's no doubt, right? Because here's the story. So after I wrote that book, I got a call from one of my teachers at Hotchkiss, who happened to be the senior class dean that year. And she said, "Can you come back and give the graduation speech at graduation this year?" And I said, "Sure, I'd be happy to do that." And I went and I did that. And sitting behind me while I gave my graduation speech was the chair of the board. And after I gave my speech, he sort of tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "I've been looking for you. Come see me in New York." And so I was like, sure, you know, again, I was like 28 years old. I said, yeah, why not? You know, I didn't really have a great sense of who this gentleman was, except he seemed important. And, you know, so we made a plan and I went to go see him in his offices and he sat me down and we had a very long ranging conversation about a variety of things. And he said to me, I think I would like you to come become a trustee at Hotchkiss. And I sort of laughed. I was like, well, you know, I'm 28 years old. I'm a Black woman. I'm a writer. You know, I'm not sure, you know, this board is filled with, you know, titans of industry. I mean, Forrest Mars was on the board at the time. The person who had brought me to his office was John Thornton, who had just retired as president of Goldman Sachs. I mean, this was a, you know, very high powered, you know, board. And I said, I don't know that I fit. And I said, I'm a little like an unusual suspect here, right? And he said, yeah, but that's exactly why you need to be there. You know, because he said, what we need more of are voices around the table that come from different perspectives. And we're not going to get to where we want to be as an institution if the only people sitting around the table are all the people who've been sitting around the table for forever. Right? We need diversity. We need strong voices of women and people of color. And, you know, he was committed to trying to make that happen at Hotchkiss. And so I said yes. And that was in 2004. And I did a 10-year stint on the board and was involved in, I chaired the gender task force looking at gender balance in the, you know, student body and the faculty. I chaired the Community Life Committee, which deals with everything that's not, you know, that was sort of outside of the classroom, and just was involved in a ton of different projects that, you know, educated me in so many different ways. And then I stepped off the board for a year. And then they called me up and said, actually, we have something that, you know, a project we need to do, and we're wondering if you would come back. And so I came.
You got 1 year off.
I got 1 year and I came back to the board and I helped lead the process that rewrote the mission of the school. And that was fascinating and really a fulfilling process. Then at the end of that, I was asked along with my, excuse me, colleague, Bob Gould, who is also a Yalie, to be co-president of the board. So now I get to lead the board, which has also been just extraordinary as a learning experience. So yeah, so I know for a fact that my great uncle had a lot to do with my being where I am now, because it was that book that opened the door for me to even have a conversation with John Thornton that led me to here.
It's so incredible. And what impact did development professionals have? What's been your exposure to them and your view on the other side? You know, you've got a lot of different perspectives here.
Yeah. You know, I am not by my nature, you know, I'm sort of like, I'm a writer. So sometimes those people are pretty introverted. And if you had told me that I would get to a point in my life where I was really comfortable asking people for money, I would have said, forget it. You're crazy. That will never happen. But I have had a number of fabulous development people in my life who have had real impact, one of whom is Tiffany Dufu, who was, when I was the chief communications officer at the White House Project, she was the chief development officer, and she went on to run the White House Project. But I can remember sitting with her and just saying, you know, in the early days, like, I don't know, how do you do that? Like, how do you just call people up or sit down and say, you know, this is how much I need you to give? And oh my gosh. And she said to me, she was like, Liz, you know, the reason this is hard for you is because you are personalizing it. You think that you're asking them for money for you, you know, and she was like, but you're not. You're asking them to become involved in a project that is going to change the world and that you feel passionately about. You know, she's like, I'm not asking them for money for me. I'm asking them to do their part to make sure that women and girls have a fair shot at, you know, leading in this world. And they should be excited about that. And I'm excited about it. And I was like, oh my gosh, what a different way of thinking about that. And it really did transform my thinking about how development works or whether I could be involved in it. And the other person who has just given me such an education on doing this with joy is the chief advancement officer at Hotchkiss, Ninette Enrique. And I feel blessed every day to get to work with her because Ninette comes with just this beautiful passion for, you know, raising resources to support a cause she believes in. And so, you know, anytime I might get nervous about like, oh, I have to ask, you know, so-and-so, and how do I have this conversation? She is phenomenal at just, you know, calming it, bringing it down a level and just saying, look, you're asking them to invest in the future. You know, you're asking them to invest in children and their education and something that you're passionate about and hopefully they are too. And so I've just been, you know, those two people I think have taught me more than I could ever have imagined about how to fundraise joyfully. And also I think, you know, sort of honoring people's best gift. Right? You know, everybody is not going to be a $5 million donor or a $10 million donor or a $25,000 donor. But, you know, the truth of just trying to make everybody feel great about what they can do. Because, you know, if everybody's doing their best, then awesome, you know, and we want people to feel good about, you know, whatever level they're giving at and, you know, feel engaged and as if they have a stake in the future of the school, whatever the size of their gift, because they do.
It's so valuable to hear that. And I wonder if for the fundraisers who are listening now, if you have any additional advice for them? You know, it was great to hear you say the joyful piece. Are there other things that you found helpful in that partnership with development that we could apply?
Yeah, I think having an honest, open flow of, you know, just an honest, open relationship is helpful. I really feel well cared for as a donor and as a trustee by our development department. They know what my interests are. Yeah, I think anything you can do to really, you know, if you're working with trustees, if you're working with people that you are sort of trying to engage in the process of helping with the development lift, I just think, you know, to the degree that you can calm the nerves, you know, help people see how their engagement is going to impact the life of the school. And I think the personalization of it too is just, you know, and by that I mean connecting asks with real people and experiences to a certain extent. You know, I mean, we have a focus coming up on financial aid. And, you know, I think having those conversations about what happens when we have the ability to admit all the kids we want to admit, regardless of their financial situation and how that changes lives, families, generations. You know, I think many people are really moved by thinking about the real people whose lives this changes. Those are the things that have been most meaningful to me, you know, being known as a donor and then also being given real instruction in how to do the work has been important to me too. Because I think
being treated as a partner.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but also very specifically, like being trained as a fundraiser, right? Mm-hmm. So that I don't go off onto calls or meetings, just sort of going, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing here, except, you know, I'm supposed to come out of this asking you for whatever, you know, right. But in fact, I go in fully prepared to be able to make a pitch and to listen to what the person, you know, is actually saying and to be in it for the long haul, right? So that it's not, you know, just the like, hey, I'm here and then I'm going away, but actually the repeated sort of touch points, you know, all of that has really helped me become much more comfortable as a, you know, trustee fundraiser.
Well, you mentioned calming the nerves. It is increasingly such a challenging landscape, you know, both in the independent school world and higher ed, with everything happening in the world. How do you think about your responsibility as a trustee in that context?
In the context of, sorry, repeat that for me, because I just took it in a different direction. Go ahead.
I was a little bit vague, but, you know, questioning the cost of education, you know, how we respond to world issues, mental health crises. I mean, there are just so many factors right now that are impacting the business of education.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that that's true. And at the end of the day, our job as, you know, institutions of education is to educate people and is to train, you know, at least, you know, in the secondary school level, we are really in the business of training people how to think, right? Not what to think, but how to think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have, because we're dealing with 13 to 19 year olds, you know, for us, there's a real caretaking element to our work. And when we're talking to alums, you know, the easiest thing to remind people is, or to ask people is to think about their experience at the school. And whether it was amazing or not totally amazing, what most people recognize is that it was in some way transformative in their lives, right? Mm-hmm. The fact of their having this education really allowed them to go on and do lots of different things. And, you know, our job is to allow for that to happen to, you know, cohorts of students bridging into the future 20, 30, 40, 100 years, right? You know, we see ourselves as a really unique educational opportunity for kids in an American landscape where we are banning books all the time and, you know, where, you know, history is contested all the time. And, you know, I happen to think that the Hotchkisses of the world, in any case, you know, are such rare birds at this point, you know, where kids really can come together and live in a truly diverse community and get challenged to think about things in ways that are just, you know, just unique in these days. And so, you know, I think of my responsibility as keeping that opportunity alive, making sure that the school is, you know, financially healthy, academically rigorous, a place for, you know, open discourse, so that kids really can come up against hard ideas, you know, in a scaffolded way because they're younger. Yeah, I think schools just have to keep at it. I don't think it's easy. It's not going to be. I mean, you know, we look at the newspaper on any given day and we know it's just, you know, it's hard, right? But I think there are still, I hope, enough people in the world who believe in the power of education to transform lives, to build leaders, to help us lead ourselves out of some of the morass we find ourselves in now, that we will be able to continue to fund our institutions, you know, over the next 30, 50, 100 years. I'm going to stay hopeful that there are enough of us who really do believe in this transformative power that we're going to keep at it. And I don't know if that's the most clarifying response, but
I think that just continuing to remember what your purpose is, mm-hmm. even though it's simple, that is really hard to do with mm-hmm. all of the different swirling conflicts and things that we are grappling with. So I love that, of really staying grounded in the purpose and the mission. And of course you were part of rebranding the mission. And so you were a good person to ask. And that was a great answer. And I would love to close with my signature question, which is, what do you know for sure?
I thought about this, and I asked my 10-year-old daughter too, like, what do you know for sure? Because I think it's a great question. And she told me that what she knows for sure is that if you want something to happen, you have to believe it will happen. And I said, oh, well, do you mean like you have to have hope? And she said, no, I don't mean hope. I mean, you have to believe it is going to happen. And then it will happen. She's like, you can have no doubt, right, in your mind that what you want to achieve is going to happen. And I said, Sophie, that's deep, you know? And she's like, no, that's how I live my life. So for my 10-year-old daughter, you know, believe it will happen. Don't doubt yourself. Believe it will happen. And it will happen. Amazing. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not the next day, but it will happen. But my answer, it's not as positive. It is ultimately positive, but you know, my answer is that life is unpredictable, right? Was it John Lennon? Life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. What I know for sure is that life is unpredictable. And what that means to me is that because it's unpredictable, we all, those of us who don't have to spend every minute just worrying about like, where are we going to get food to feed our families? Like, how are we going to make it from today to tomorrow? For those of us who are not involved in like the daily scratching out of life, that unpredictability to me means that we better spend our time really seriously doing the things that bring us joy and that have real impact on the world around us. So that's how I try to shape my life, is to think to myself, you know, is what I'm doing today, does it make me happy? And does it help humanity? I'm thinking of Yale, for humanity.
Right,
Does it help, you know, is it making some sort of impact on the world around me? That's what I know for sure. Unpredictability means get busy living your life and making an impact.
That is amazing, Liz. Thank you so much. This was such an inspiring conversation. And I'm just so grateful that you shared it with us.
Oh, it was great to be with you. Thank you so much. It's great.
This is the last episode of calendar year 2023, and it wraps 4 years of the development debrief. Thank you for your support. Thank you for sharing this podcast with friends, family, and colleagues. Thank you for reaching out to me on LinkedIn and for following the podcast at Dev Debrief on Instagram. I hope you all have a wonderful end of the year with friends and family, and I look forward to picking up in 2024.